Welcome to the Old Chicks No Shit podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Artherton. This podcast is dedicated to helping midlife women step into the inherent power and wisdom of a time of life when they often feel overlooked and underrepresented and even begin to doubt themselves. Each week, we will cover information and inspirational topics along with real stories from real women who are defying cultural stereotypes and perceptions of midlife. Women who are reinventing themselves, starting businesses, chasing their dreams, and tackling challenges they never thought possible. Hey, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Old Chicks No Shit podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Artherton. And on today's episode, we are going to be talking about emotional intelligence. I think we've all heard the term and probably curious as to what it really means and how it impacts your life. So today we are going to unpack that with my guest, who is Patrick Kilcar, a psychologist and head of Georgetown University's Center for Personal Development. He is also a master practitioner in emotional intelligence and uses it within your clinical practice. Am I right?
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about why you decided to study emotional intelligence. Like, what about that was like really appealing to you that you wanted to become a master in this? And like, what is it, I guess, really?
Sure. I mean, well, both of them. 10 years ago, I went to this conference, as you know, we all do in our particular professions. And I sat in on a workshop that was about emotional intelligence. And I'd read a little bit about it. You know, Dan Goleman's book in 1995 kind of set the stage, which was called Emotional Intelligence. And, you know, drew many, many people, you know, across the spectrum into thinking about it and what really is it. And I listened to this woman and I was just entranced by what she was saying and how she was talking about it, what it can really do for individuals, what it can do for the workplace. And at that time, which is still true today, I believe, that the EQI was really developed for the workplace or higher education. And about how are really teams or groups of people really working together. I listened to her and she started talking about these 15 competencies. And it just made absolute and complete sense. You know, most people that are in the mental health field and are clinicians, we're always kind of looking for that golden goose and that one thing that's going to make all the difference and create tremendous growth opportunities for our clients. It's just not out there. The Holy Grail is not out there. However, at that moment, in listening to these 15 competencies that start with self-regard, ends with optimism, just made complete sense. So after I went up and talked with her, talked about how much I liked it, we stayed in contact. And then Multi-Health Systems, MHS in Toronto, that owns the tool, Steve Stein, who's the president, invited me to come for a week-long training. And I went there and then I was the external consultant for MHS in doing primarily colleges and universities, not so much going into the boardroom. And I just loved it. And fast forward, I gave a presentation in a class at Georgetown University on emotional intelligence, on the EQI. And one of the TAs for that professor came and said, "Can I take the EQI?" And I said, "Sure." So he came in, we started talking more clinically, he took it. And that was the beginning of me using the EQI, not again in the boardroom or the classroom, to use it individually in the clinical setting. And it just began to blow my mind in what was happening, how people were understanding it, and really utilizing it as they move toward whatever their therapeutic goals are. And in terms of what emotional intelligence is, your point is a good one. It's out there. It's in the popular press. There are probably lots of definitions. The definition that makes sense to me, Patrick, is it's understanding, and we're talking about me, and I think this is true of anybody, understanding the emotions that I experience in my life. Are there emotions that really move me toward what I want and what I need relationally or otherwise? Yes. And are the emotions I'm experiencing taking me there? So how do I manage anger? How do I manage frustration? How do I manage these kind of deep, big feelings that come up? And am I doing it in a way that allows me to grow and even strengthen a relationship or tear down a relationship. So it's me understanding what is happening in my emotional field. How is that impacting the people in front of me in my life, whether it's work or home, it doesn't matter. How is it impacting? And how are the emotions of someone else impacting me? And so it's this socio-emotional understanding that we have power over what we do, what we say, how we act. At 9 or 10, growing up in our families, maybe we didn't have that power.
Right.
We didn't have that ability. But now, as adults, we do. And it's the piece about it that I think is so brilliant. Everything about emotional intelligence is learned. It's not right. Like being born extrovert or introvert, right?
Right.
It's learned. And if something's learned, something else can be learned around it. If we so desire, or if we feel we can do it. I know it's long-winded.
No. I mean, I love that definition because, you know, I view, and, you know, in the studies that I've done, I view emotions as energy, right? And energy is all around us and it ripples. Oh, wait. So when I control my emotions, therefore my energy, I can impact the energy in a room of other people, right? By my own response. But getting to that place requires a level of what I call centered awareness or like consciousness, right? To be able to say that, like, and to be able to know that whatever emotion I'm experiencing right now is mine. It's fully available to me to control, right? And that I'm not necessarily looking at it as in, you made me feel this way.
Yes. And we hear that all the time.
Right.
You know, you made me angry.
Right.
And no, I didn't. This drives my wife nuts when she'll say, you're making me angry. You made me angry. I said, no, baby, I really did. And she goes, stop that psychological kind of crap on me. That I said, I'm not. You're getting angry. So you own it. If you're getting angry and whatever's going on, own it. And if you're getting angry, there's a reason.
Yes.
You know, it's just like having some kind of a wound. Triage it. What does it need?
Right.
Anger is a message that either our needs aren't being met, our expectations aren't being met, or something previously unresolved keeps kind of,
right,
you know, forging it, right, just coming out into the middle of what we're doing and affecting whatever it is that we're doing.
Right. So asking the question, like for me, like, why am I feeling angry right now? Like, what did that, like, what about what that person just said is like causing, yes, me to feel angry, right?
Yes.
And then
that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, completely. And it's also this interesting piece that what you're talking about, Jennifer, is, I think, the most important competency of these 15 competencies. And it's emotional self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're talking about, because, right, emotional self-awareness suggests two things. If I'm emotionally self-aware, I'm taking ownership for what's going on with me, and I'm taking responsibility for it.
Right.
If I do those two things, anything is possible. You know, people will say to me that I meet, or if I'm, you know, doing a program or a training, God, you know, with all this experience, you must not get angry anymore. You must have really amazing emotional intelligence. Sometimes I do, and definitely sometimes I don't.
Right.
And being emotionally intelligent is not a destination. It's just this ongoing process that ebbs and flows, just the way our blood does coursing through our veins. Being an emotionally intelligent person requires ongoing work, starting with exactly what you're saying, being emotionally self-aware and owning it, whatever is going on.
So how have you seen emotional intelligence like impact somebody's life? Like, what, let me rephrase this a little bit. So you have a person who maybe their life feels like a little bit out of control because they're being buffered by what the boss does, what the, you know, my husband said, what my kids want, like all of these kinds of things, right? And they're feeling like they're in the middle of a storm and they're just reacting to all of this stuff coming at,
sure,
them, right? Which I think is a common way of being for a lot of us, right? Like, we're taking, yes, on all of these things. Like, how do we begin to develop, I guess, that sense of emotional intelligence, right? So I'm in the middle of the storm. How do I begin to be able to find my part in it, or to be able to get to that level of awareness?
Again, it's a brilliant question, because what can I do to find some sense of balance, even when I'm in the presence of those that don't have it or aren't fostering it. And when I talk with clients or really anybody, I think in a very simplistic way, however, for me, it really makes a lot of sense. And it's three things. What can I control in my life right now? Literally control. And it comes down to one thing, is me. I can only control right. what I do, what I don't do, what I at times feel or what I don't feel completely. The second bucket is a pretty important one, and that's what can I influence? And emotionally intelligent people, because they are in that place where they don't let their emotions hijack their thinking, hijack their emotions, they generally are people that are pretty good influencers to the people around them. But the third bucket, an important bucket where, oddly enough, most of us spend a lot of our time, is that bucket of what I can't control and what I cannot influence. But we spend so much time in that place. We know it is that definition of insanity, right? We know it's not working, yet we keep doing it. And so if I was talking to a client this morning, and a really remarkable woman, and very smart, and she's trying to determine, does she go back into the world of finance or does she start her own business? And she's capable of both. However, she began talking about the bosses that she had in corporate America, either in the world of design or finance, 99% men. And she was bullied. She was taken advantage of. She was made to feel demeaned in the presence of these people. And first and foremost, that kind of behavior should never be allowed. It is, though, right? So we're talking, and she said, you know what? I don't want to go back into a place where I'm with somebody who does not lead with two things. They don't lead with kindness, and they don't lead with respect. And I said, you know, go, girl. You're exactly right. So she began to really see the business that she wants to do, how she wants to go after it. And there's legitimate fear attached to it. And I think emotionally intelligent people, even though they feel fear, even though they worry, even though they may be afraid, they do it anyway because they know they can. And they marshal the right kind of supports around them to make that happen. And it goes back to your question. What do you do when you're around people who are just not good people, who are toxic in our life? Begin to look for an exit strategy. You know, last week, I got this note from somebody that read my book. And they said, you know, I really love the part in the book where you talked about if we're in the presence of toxic people, even if they share our blood, it should never be tolerated and allowed. You give people an opportunity to shift and change. And if they don't, you find an exit strategy. Yeah. And that, if we share blood with people, if we grew up in an environment where we were taught to tolerate ridiculousness and or enable ridiculous behavior. It's really hard to break that particular learning. It can happen, though. And on the other side of it, I think, is this real notion of emotional freedom. And right. that's what I talk with my clients most about, or when I'm giving workshops. What does it mean to achieve a level of emotional freedom, emotional balance in your life? What would it really look like?
Yeah, because I was reading your book, you know, the thing that kept coming up to me was this idea of, and when you talk about emotional freedom, this might be what you mean, so correct me if I'm wrong, but this idea that I am no longer reacting to a situation, like I'm aware enough to be able to choose, right? Like I'm not just like somebody says, somebody does, and then all of a sudden I'm here in this place, right? But that I can be aware enough that I can be like, oh, I'm being triggered right now and I really don't want to yell at this person. So I'm going to choose a different response. And that level of freedom and I think autonomy, right? Like that you're not being like, that's what I kept kind of coming back to in like the stories that you told in your book, right? Is that the people are making choices as opposed to being like buffeted by whatever's happening.
You said it perfectly, you know, making choices versus being reactive to your environment. We're being reactive because of early kind of childhood learning, or in the arc of our development, we were taught to really tolerate a lot of ridiculousness. And what you're talking about is completely spot on. It's being able to go, okay, where do I begin? Where do other people end and vice versa? And how do I spot people that are not good for me, that do create this level of toxicity? And then what do I really do? And it is your point is so perfect. It's about choosing.
Yeah.
As adults, we no longer have to be reactive. But the minute we get in a car and we go out on the highway, you're just surrounded by people, you know, in these two-ton vehicles reacting to the world, getting pissed off and cutting each other off and just working out whatever's going on the highway and in a dangerous way. And the choices that we have, I think within which it creates liberation.
Yeah.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, I think the world would look a whole lot different if we all had the capacity to be able to choose responses so that people, like you said, are not like basically projecting their stuff all over each other. And then, right?
Yes. And we're just imposing on each other our own frailty.
Yeah.
Or imposing on other people our own brokenness. And you really yeah. see that when you're looking at parents and their children.
Oh, yeah.
Big time. And it's okay. You know, being a parent, I think of anything I've done in my life has required the most out of me to be in a place where my kids, our kids, feel nourished. They feel they can make mistakes. They feel that they really are okay. I mean, they're wonderful people walking through this world. Doing it, though, is so hard because of all the messages counter to that that they receive in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I have a daughter, Olympia, who's 9, who is often bullied. And I don't know why. You know, she's such a little love. Of course, I'm biased. But I think about, you know, what must it be like for her as this little 9-year-old being bullied by kids that just really aren't even thinking about what they're doing? And the depth of pain that goes with that. And it creates pain. It creates pain yeah. that kind of stands the test of time and goes with us.
Yeah.
So your piece around choice is absolutely the foundation of all of it.
Yeah. And I think too, even like, you know, in your intimate relationships, like with your, you know, your husband, partner, whatever, right? Like I know in my experience, like there's been times where I'm like, you know, my partner will do something and I will be like, I can feel it. Like I can literally feel it. Like I'm triggered. Right.
And you're triggered.
Right.
Absolutely.
And that would generally start a fight, right? Because then I would react. Right. And then the whole thing would just literally unravel from that point on. Right. And then when I realized that, I was like, oh, I can feel this. I can honor that feeling and I can feel it, but I can actually choose a different response. And in choosing a different response, it actually has had the impact of like, I guess that like almost dialing down that feeling. So I don't feel as reactive. Right. And I'm choosing that yes. response. And in choosing my response, right, it elicits a completely different response on his part. Right. And then the That's whole it. Thing that would have before erupted into a, you know, an hour long argument, it's like, oh, I can actually impact my own surroundings by how I react to my emotions. And that for yes. me, when I got that, I was like, bingo, it's so powerful.
Good. Absolutely. It is. And, you know, being aware that what we do, it has an impact on the people around us. And if I choose not to be angry, but I step up and let's say with your partner, you say, you know what, that really bothered me. It hurt. And I just want to let you know that.
Yeah.
I don't remember where I heard this statistic, but the number of people that when they have a big feeling and they that step in and say, you know what, that really hurt, or it felt really inappropriate, or mm-hmm. whatever it would be, but stepping in and respectfully talking about what it felt like, the number of people that do this on the planet is 2%. So what are they doing aside from that?
Right.
Passive aggression, being aggressive, withdrawing, or self-blame. All of that kind of funnels into this place. It was shocking when I heard it. When I talk about this in groups or in the classroom or wherever, you see everybody around us go, oh yeah, I would never do that. I would never actually say how I feel. And it's this piece, like, again, it's about choice, but how liberating I think it would be for us to, again, be a socially and emotionally aware where we can talk in real time about what we're experiencing and move on. You're right. What would have been an hour, emotional boxing match with your partner turned into something positive.
Yeah.
And what do we do with our feelings? Recently, my wife was upstairs in the bedroom and she goes, "Hey, you know what? You owe me $150. And I went, "Okay, for what though?" She goes, "Look, if you're going to treat me like a mate, you're going to pay me like a mate." And I went, "Oh, hell." And I started laughing and she was laughing, but she was right. I mean, she was absolutely right. And I thought being that it was such a funny way to kind of do it. And I think even the way that she did bring it up, it had such an impact on me that it was wonderful. So, I mean, actually, even if we feel distressed or we feel put out or we feel taken advantage of, which I'm assuming she was feeling some of that, to actually have fun with it. My God, what would that be like?
Yeah.
And it's all within that space of how we reply, what we do.
Yeah.
And what do we do with these emotions?
So do you think the reason why only 2% of us have the capability to do that is because we have never been taught how to be with our emotions?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, think about this. Your podcast goes out to so many people, many of whom are women. And there are no more emotional human beings on the planet than women. Mm-hmm. And even with that said, growing up, there are these fears that are kind of injected into us as we grow up about talking about what we need or this little thing in our head saying, "I don't deserve X, Y, Z," or in doing this, it's going to create a problem. It's being able to really recognize the importance of what we're feeling at the moment and know that if we step up with our children, with our partner, with our boss, whatever it may be, and be able to say what it feels like. It just takes us farther down that road of truly being heard. Because I think so many people suffer in this world because they're just not heard.
Yeah. You know, that's so true, because if you grew up in the corporate culture like I did and like many of my listeners did, the number one thing from the very beginning of time is like, you do not show emotion. Like, you just keep that thing tightly locked up. And I remember going through my divorce and I told not a single solitary soul at work about what was happening in my life because I didn't want anybody to think that I couldn't handle my life, right? Because they might think less of me at work. So I stuffed it down and stuffed it down. You know, there would be days I would close my office door and I would cry. And then I would put my game face on, open the door and be okay. Until one day it literally bubbled over. I could not contain it anymore. And in front of the president of our company, I burst into tears. And I was expecting I literally couldn't control it. And I was expecting, oh, I'm going to be walked out the door. And instead what happened was, you know, he just looked at me and he's like, "What's going on?" And then I, you know, told him the whole thing. And he's just like, "Okay, this is how we're going to support you. Boom, 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 boom." And I walked away from that conversation going, "Geez, why did I not cry at work before this, man? It could have been a whole lot easier."
Yeah. Not only that, though, it was the fear that kept you from being able to talk about it.
Right.
And, you know, thank God that man in your life at that moment, he wasn't a boss.
No.
You know, he wasn't a suit. He was a leader. I mean, he stepped in for you to feel cared for in an environment that's often pretty antiseptic, which is the workplace. And his response really was unexpected.
Yeah.
But that's the response we can only hope for.
Well, exactly. But like that, you know, so I think about this and I think about emotional intelligence. I think about like, when you've spent your whole life trying to stuff down all of the emotions that you have, basically you're trying to make yourself a robot, but you're a human, right?
Absolutely.
And then we wonder why, like when there has not been space, like even, you know, in your family, like even in my family, like, you know, growing up, there wasn't a whole lot of space to hold emotion. And so you learn how, then you become completely disassociated from what your emotions are. You can't even tell anger from sadness from anything. Right. And so dealing with all of that stuff and like learning your own emotions, like that's so critical. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that if we could raise emotionally intelligent children by giving space and honoring their emotions and teaching them, you know, that first of all, it's okay, and to trust themselves and their emotions. I feel like we could have a whole different society, a whole different culture.
You're exactly right. I mean, being able to be real with what we feel is, it would be groundbreaking. And that to raise children who across the board grow up going through school, and instead of making fun of each other, instead of bullying each other, instead of making other people feel like a victim, this child steps into this environment and leads the way through respect and kindness.
Yeah.
And that it, and how hard is it? It's hard because as parents, as much as we want things to go well for our kids and for our kids to flourish in every way possible, our own woundedness just trips us up and gets in the way. And to exactly what you were saying, Jennifer, creates these triggers that just bind us emotionally.
Yeah.
And being aware of it, wanting to shift and change it, is the beginning of that journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation with you today is because, you know, so many of us grow up like I did. And then, you know, we reach this phase of life where it's like, we can no longer, like when you stuff your emotions, it's going to come out somewhere. It's going to come out sideways, right? So whether that comes out as a divorce or an illness, for me, it was like physical burnout. You get to a point where you're like, okay, I can no longer tolerate living this way. It just doesn't feel right. But then on the other side of I can no longer tolerate it is this vast canyon that I have no, how do I figure out how to get across that? And I feel like, especially during the menopausal years, so many women reach that point where things that we've been able to do before or things that served us before are no longer serving us. And what got us here is not going to get us to where we want to go for the next chapter of our life. And I feel like emotional intelligence is a huge part of that in terms of being able to come to terms with, you know, the emotions that are from our past, that came from experience, that, you know, were ingrained in us as children or whatever, and come to terms with them and then figure out what to do with them.
Boy, completely. And if you think about, if you go back in time and back in corporate America, how long did you go feeling truly burned out?
Oh, a long time before I actually physically got burned out. Yes.
Years. So you think about the cost of that.
Yeah.
You know, for you, because when we're in a place like that, we're at a breakneck pace. We feel like we're not doing enough or we're never enough. It's just, it's like an elephant sitting on you that you want to slow it down. You want to push this big thing off. You're not sure how to do it. You're not sure who would really be there and support you to do it. And you just keep grinding. Yeah. And in doing it, just grinding yourself down.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's the solution to that? I don't immediately know, other than to be, if for you or me or anybody, to be able to go, you know what? Whatever I'm doing is not working.
Yeah.
It feels too much. It's taking too much of a toll. It has to change.
Yeah.
And that change begins with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's, I mean, you lived for years this way, and it's just.
Well, I mean, there was a big part of me, and I hear this a lot with my clients, right? There was a big part of me that knew I wasn't living authentically like who I was, because I kind of had kind of formed this persona that was out in the world, right? That was kind of like my protection, right? But it wasn't who I was. And the distance between this like persona that I had created and who I actually was as a person was just like, managing that was becoming too difficult. And I hear this from my clients who are like, you know, I really want to live this next chapter of my life authentically, right? Which means kind of breaking down kind of those masks or those barriers. And then, but then when you break it down, you have to come to terms with the person behind that. And
who am I?
Who exactly? That's the question, right? Like, I must hear this every week. Like, who am I? I don't even know, right?
Yes. You and the both of us.
Yeah.
In talking with people, that you're right. It's a bit like smoke and mirrors that look great, really smart, or very talented, and yet inside just feel decimated. And yet you can't see that. What you see is a beautiful woman, you know, poised, smart. The feeling, though, is what it's taking just to prop that up.
Yeah.
and to move through it. And part of it is, I think the EQI, the reason why I love it, is there's this report that it gives, a very lengthy report, but there's one page on the EQI that shows you the 15 competencies, and it's color-coded. When people look at it, what do? We've all been to school. We immediately go down to the lowest, right? Whatever's the lowest, we go, oh, there it is. Not the highest, but the lowest. And it's this piece of, when I look at it, I see a narrative. I see, you know, the touch points in somebody's life and what all these different competencies really mean in terms of their lived experience. And when I begin talking with people about what I see, it's overwhelming oftentimes. They go, how do you even see all that? I said, look, I'm not a soothsayer. It's just right here. It's what you're feeling going through your life right now. And for people to be able to somehow stop the smoke and mirrors, allow themselves to really be seen in the world. And what does that mean? If I think of one emotion per se, it's kind of an emotion and a thought. It's more of an emotion that drives so much of what doesn't happen in this world is fear. Fear. You know, years ago, I heard this American Indian lore, this story that I thought was just amazing. And obviously, I've carried it with me to this day. And some may have heard that, some of your audience. However, there's a grandfather who's going on a journey with his granddaughter and his grandson. And into the journey, they're sitting by this beautiful river, you know, water cascading over the rocks. And he looks at these two, you know, who are putting their feet in the water. And he goes, I need to share with them what's going on with me. And he goes down to them and he says, I want to let you both know that there's a war going on in me. You can't see it, but it's there and I feel it all the time. And it's a war between two wolves. One is the wolf of hope and love, and the other is the wolf of fear and hate. And so the grandson goes, well, what do you feed these wolves? And he goes, exactly what I'm saying. This good, kind, loving wolf is fed hope. This out of control, mean, voracious wolf is fed fear. And the granddaughter looks and says, well, who wins in this war? And the grandfather goes, it's the one you feed. And so much of our life is feeding this wolf of fear.
Yeah.
And for complete understandable reasons, completely.
Yeah.
But when I see people choose not to feed that wolf anymore and feed this wolf of hope and love, it's astounding what happens. Completely.
Yeah. I love that story. You know, it's, I always think of it in the terms again of energy, like, you know, energy goes where thought flows, right? So what thoughts are you thinking, right? And what are you giving energy to?
Completely.
Right?
Completely. In terms, I'm glad you're kind of going back to it. I mean, every day I say to somebody that, how are they thinking about where they are in the world? Is it positive? Is it negative? Right. And if they're falling kind of toward the negative, I go, you know, regardless of what someone believes or doesn't believe religiously, what I think everybody would agree on is that the universe is energy. We're an extension of that universe. We're an extension of that energy. What we put out matters.
Yeah.
And so it's that piece of beginning to invite people away from that self-condemnation, that negativity, toward this positive place of what's possible.
Yeah.
And it's hard though. It's because we've been so ingrained to stay in that place of self-doubt.
Yeah, that is so true. I mean, you know, we tend to focus on all of the things that could go wrong as opposed to the equally
what can go right.
Could go right, right? We naturally assume that what we don't know is going to be worse than what we know. Even if we hate what we know.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, yeah. What a great way to kind of frame it. And, you know, hearing over the messages that you bring to those that you serve day in and day out, clients, those listening to the podcast, or them reading it or hearing it somewhere else, hopefully begins to, instead of throwing these mustard seeds on concrete where they just evaporate, they begin to think, oh, you know what? This is something that I can change.
Yeah.
Because I hear it all the time and I want to change it. And so the movement is away from this wolf of fear toward truly what is possible.
Yeah.
And we're not programmed for that.
Yeah. And you just touched on something which I think is incredibly important, and that is belief and identity. Right? Like, who do we see ourselves to be and what do we believe about what's possible? And I think probably of all the work I do, those two things are probably the most important, or the thing that I see the most in people, because, and it was true for me, right? Like, if I wasn't, you know, at what I call my midlife crisis, you know, where I found myself divorced, unemployed, an empty nester and bedridden with a stress-related illness, right? If I wasn't wife, mother, oh, and my kid left to go to school, right? So if I wasn't wife, mother, corporate executive, and at the time I was like big into fitness, right? If I couldn't do those things, then who was I, right? Because my identity was so wrapped up in those roles, right?
Yes.
And, you know, all of those roles required me to be a certain way, but that certain way that I was, it wasn't actually me. It was the person I had become. And I didn't believe in anything that didn't have a title, right? Didn't have a role, because that was where my identity was. So what you were talking about, possibility, that was the biggest gap for me, is like, if it's not this, then what? There's nothing else.
Yes. I had a client who was talking about his good friend, and the client was a veteran of the Afghani war. And his very good friend was shot in the head, was medevaced out. And 2 years after this whole thing, my client went down to visit him in North Carolina. And my client's going up to the door and he's going to knock on the door, and the door opens and this guy's wife and mother meet him at the door. And they said to him, listen, he has no memory of really who he used to be before being wounded. And please don't bring up stories about stuff that he did. Now, apparently this guy was larger than life. He drank like a fish. He smoked like a chimney, cursed like you wouldn't believe. It had this enormous heart. So my client said to the mother in the wife, yeah, of course, of course. So he went out in the backyard. They were having iced tea and they were talking. And then the guy says to my client, hey, brother, I want to ask you a question. He goes, sure. He goes, what did my mother and my wife say to you when they met you at the door? He said, hey, they just said, don't get y'all excited. You know, obviously you've been through and are still going through a lot. And just to, you know, keep it as vanilla as possible. He goes, now I'm going to ask you one more time. What did they say to you? And he said, okay. They said, you have no memory of what your life was like prior to being wounded. And please don't bring up any of the stories. And the guy kind of shakes his head and he puts his iced tea down and he goes, I remember everything, everything, and began to tell my client's stories, which indicated absolutely he remembered it. My client goes, I don't understand. Well, you know, why not let people know? Why not? I'm sure they would love to know that, you know, that this wound didn't result in you losing all of these memories and ideas and thoughts. He goes, that wound to my head provided me an opportunity to be more of the man I want to be.
Oh,
wow.
I love that.
And I mean, that moment changed my client, changed him.
Yeah.
And that, you know, does it take a bullet to our head to come to that place of saying, I want to be my best self, I can be. No, it's true. I mean, this guy, for whatever reason, chose that route. And it was really important to him, not so much that he forgot the past and stuff that he did, that everybody else around him forgot it and were able to see him live very differently. And that to me is just so powerful.
Yeah.
That what we all can do to begin to reshape parts of our life that may feel like they're out of balance or they're a little too.
Yeah, I love that, because to your point, it didn't take a bullet to the head for him to decide to become the man he wanted to be. It literally took a decision. And he used that as the decision
Bravo.
Point.
Bravo. That's exactly it. You know, and think about, I mean, I'm imagining what you said a moment ago about you, you know, out of the corporate rat race at that moment, no longer married, children out going to college, school, doing whatever, gone, and you're all alone with you. And I think there's only two ways that that can go. One is into just a profound depression that lasts for a very long time. And depression was there for you. It was. Yep. But I think it was the little D rather than the big D.
For sure.
And you took that, like this guy with the bullet, you took that as an opportunity to really reshape who you are in the world and for the world to really see you.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is most manifest through what you're doing right this minute.
Yeah.
In inviting people to share their ideas or tell their stories or give us guidance about a way that we can live just a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the one thing that, you know, that was very present for me in all of that was like, if I'm the creator of my life, then I made this mess, right? And if I want my life to be different, then I need to show up differently in it. And then the other part of that is I had just turned 50 and I'm like, okay, I have a whole maybe 30, maybe 40 years ahead of me, God willing, right? And like, what am I going to do for 30 years? Am I just going to be like coast into the finish line and be miserable the whole time? Like I have 30 years. It's like the longest chapter of my life yet. And I get to choose what that looks like. And that for me was the profound moment where I was like, okay, what are you choosing? And that's became the journey, right?
Yes. And all of those things somehow played a role in who you are today and what you're doing today. And it's, at that moment, right at the moment of impact, it's hard to believe that something really profound is going to come out of that. And yet it did.
Yeah.
And I do feel at that there was a moment in all of that where you just began almost immediately shifting your energy toward, okay, what I'm going through now is just not good.
Yeah.
And however, I'm smart, talented, all of these important things. What do I want to do with it? And then that trajectory just changed.
Well, and I think the important part about that too is, you know, okay, I made the decision, but I also didn't get to escape all of the emotions that I had stuffed down over years and years and years and years, because in that process, they all came up, right? Which was where I was like, okay, now I'm faced with this thing, right? And to your point, you know, that you made earlier, was I always aware and making a choice? No, there was lots of reacting in there and there was lots. But over time, you know, as I like literally sat and faced my emotions and I learned about them and I learned about where they came from and why they were protecting me. And the more I learned, the more I kind of came to terms with the fact that like, oh, okay, I can manage this thing. It's okay to let sadness out. It's okay, you know, to experience anger or grief. Right?
Yes.
You know, or the not enoughness or all whatever was coming up, right? But it took some time. And that's why I think this concept of emotional awareness and intelligence is so critical, because no matter where we are and whatever decision we make, we don't get to like skip over that stuff. We still have to deal with it, but we can deal with it in a different way.
You're absolutely right. And kind of in hearing you talk about your own movement and your own journey, I think about these people in the book, which are just ordinary people, which at times felt like doing extraordinary things. However, that choice point that you talk about for you, and I absolutely, that's been there for me in my life. It's choosing to move in a direction that's going to highlight everything we want to be in the world. And even though in moving that direction may feel very scary, I mean, think about it. For 20 years or 30 years or whatever, you knew corporate America, you knew what you did, you know, what it meant to be a spouse, what it meant to be a mom, all these things that just changed, which felt like on a dime.
Yeah, which it was. Yeah.
It really, I mean, it's what it sounds like. And you just did not let go of the rope.
Yeah.
You didn't.
Well, and I did for a while. I wallowed in it for a bit.
Well, we all do. I mean, look, that's just part of the journey.
Yeah.
And if you didn't wallow, you know, write a book about that. I want to read it. But as you move through the wallowing, though, all of a sudden you go, okay, really, what do I want to be there? I had a good friend say to me once, you know, our childhood, young adulthood is spent people, you know, taking all this stuff and putting it in our backpack. And then in our adult years, it's spent us reaching in there and pulling all the crap out that's not ours. and keeping what is. And I thought that was just so great because it's so true. Really is true. That's what, and on your podcast, the ones that I listen to, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, what is yours and what is not?
Yeah.
And celebrate what's you, let go of what's not.
Yeah.
Easily said, true.
Yeah.
But that's a message we all need to hear.
Yeah. I call it the great unlearning. Like this chapter is literally the great unlearning. Right. Everything right. you've learned, absolutely. Throw it out the window, start over. Boom.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And look what can happen. I mean, you literally, you know, you're the phoenix rising out of a lot of that ash, a lot of that heartache, a lot of, in a way that anybody that's paying attention, it offers hope. It offers hope.
And that's really what I wanted to do with this podcast, really, is to share the message of hope that, you know, like through conversations like you and through conversations with other women who have reinvented their lives, that anything is possible, right? Like there is possibility, there is hope, and that there's, you know, people are taking a little bit of inspiration and education that can help them build, you know, enough to feed that wolf of hope, right?
Yes.
And to keep that going. So here's my question to you. So somebody comes to you and they take the EQI right. test or the 2.0 or whatever it is, right?
Yes.
What does that tell them?
So I'll give you an example of a young woman that came to see me. She was a physician and had great friends. And on paper, she said, I have a great life. I don't feel like I have a great life. Something's missing. Something's wrong. So generally, I'll offer the EQI to somebody after they come to the fourth visit, because it means they're going to stay, that they're in, and that it that we can take this information from the EQI and unfurl it over the course of the clinical time I have with this person. And versus what happens in corporate America, you take the EQI, you get a 45-minute telephone interview or breakdown with whoever is facilitating a workshop, and that's it, 45 minutes. And I say in the book, that's kind of like having a Ferrari and never taking it out of first gear. And but so we get the results of her EQI, and immediately she's kind of looking at it and she's starting to well up. There's kind of tears. And usually when a client looks at what I'm looking at on this page three, that has all this information, all these the competencies. You know, they see highs and lows, but they don't necessarily see what I see. She was seeing what I was seeing, which was amazing. And I asked her, I said, what are you seeing? She goes, my emotional self-awareness is incredibly high. And sometimes with competencies, just like being too low, it can be too high where it can present problems. For instance, if I'm really low on assertiveness, I'm a doormat. If I'm way strong on assertiveness compared to maybe other competencies, I may be a bully and aggressive, not assertive. So she looks, emotional self-awareness was really high. Her emotional expression was really low. So she feels all this big stuff. She's completely aware of it and doesn't say anything. Her ability to tolerate stress, stress tolerance, was also very high. Her flexibility score was incredibly high, meaning she's super flexible. If the flexibility score is low, it means that you really don't tolerate change very well. For her, it was really high. And her social awareness, her ability to give back socially, was also really high. And I said, well, what does this say to you? Well, everybody comes to me, all of my friends, to talk about what's going on and their pain and their hurt. I never talk to anybody about this. None of my friends. And she goes, I feel like a doormat, that everybody kind of just comes to me to fix stuff and to take care of stuff. And she was getting ready to go on a big trip with seven friends. And what she typically has done, she does everything. She books the venue, she gets the hotel, she does all this stuff for them. They just all agree on where they're going to go. And I said, well, what about this? What about if you sent them an email and said, you know what, I'm underwater, work is just really tough, I don't have time, can you do it? And she goes, no, I can't do that. I said, yeah, you can, and what if you did? So at the computer, she was shaking like she'd been out in the cold for 3 hours, and sent the email to her friend saying, can you do this? having never done anything like this before. 2 hours later, she sent their responses. And it went kind of like this. You go, girl. Hey, I'm here for you. Look, you've carried our big fat asses long enough. Every single one was honoring the fact and recognizing that she's always been the one to do it. And she said, as she was sending it to me, you know, I'm sobbing out of joy in a way I never have.
Yeah, I mean, that's beautiful. And that's so relatable, because I feel like there's probably a million women right now listening who are going, me, that's me.
Hello. Yeah, absolutely. And the piece is that many of these individuals you're talking about, they're aware of it. It's not like it's outside of their awareness per se. They just don't know what to do about it.
Right.
And to feed the wolf of hope would be to take time and think about, or talk about with a trusted person, leveling the playing field would look like what? And, you know, or my wife saying, hey, you owe me $150. You know, what is going to allow that leveling to occur so that not only are we giving our best to those we love, we're getting the best from those we love. And making that kind of change, to your point right in the beginning, it can really feel daunting and scary, you know, that fear piece.
Yeah.
But change is what, as adults now, we can do.
So are people ever surprised by their EQI results? Or like you said, do most people kind of, it's like confirmation from them? Or do you have you had cases where people are like, what? That's not me.
Well, not so much, whoa, that's not me. Most people go, yeah, that's pretty accurate. And remember, the EQI, it's like taking an x-ray of your social emotional life right now. It shifts and changes. It remains fairly stable over time, but it can shift and change. And, you know, it's not like the color of our eyes or being introvert or extrovert, which generally doesn't shift a lot. And yes, people go, yeah. But then what they do, they begin to see how what they're looking at, how it's associated, the story it tells, the place that they are emotionally and socially, with an eye on, if you were to change one or two of these competencies, what would it be? How would you kind of choose which one? Because if I, for Patrick, if I chose self-regard, I want to feel better in my own skin. It would be like hanging right above your head would be a mobile, the kind that little babies have in their crib. And it's completely still. But if you touch just one of those 15, what happens? Everything moves.
Right.
And if I choose one and I really go after it and spend time on it, it will by its very nature begin to impact and affect the others. Because it's more like they're connected like a spider web, some more proximal, some more distal. But they're all connected.
Right.
And so movement in one affects the others right. in a way that we.
So are there ways for people to figure out, like, okay, the first place to start, like without taking the EQ?
Sure. And that's kind of the reason for the book.
Right.
That I'm not sure of the feeling that you had when you were reading it, but it's written in such a way that as you're reading it, you become absolutely familiar with the 15 competencies.
Right.
You know them, you feel them. And that as you're reading these stories about what other people have done, the movement in their own life, the way they look at the competencies, you know, by the end of the book, I think we can step back and just using the competencies, get a pretty good sense of where we are.
Right. Yeah.
And I often use just when I'm doing trainings and other different things, sometimes I use just the competencies. I don't use the quote unquote EQI.
Right.
And for people to really be able to go, yeah, you know what? I do feel like my assertiveness is too low, or I do feel my stress tolerance is way too high, or my optimism is particularly low, that you begin to see it. And then as you step back and acknowledge it, what's the impact?
Yeah.
What does it really look like in your life?
Yeah. Yeah. So
what can change?
Yeah. It's interesting because as I was reading the book, the one about assertiveness and, you know, some places in my life, not in every place, but there are some places in my life where I don't speak up and I kind of have this like little grumble about things, right? That I just keep to myself. And I was like, oh, I wonder what would happen if I took a step forward, if I, you know,
if you found your voice in that moment, because yeah. also what you're saying, Jennifer, is brilliant in that, look, you know, it's not like this is our life. I'm the same in every situation across. No.
Yeah.
There are times where I may be incredibly assertive and other times I'm not. I hold it. And that piece of kind of going, I wonder what it would be like if I allowed my voice to kind of come forth in this yeah. situation or in that situation. And that's that beautiful, wonderful moment of personal growth, of being yeah. able to go, okay, I'm going to give it a shot because it can be scary. If it yeah. wasn't scary, we'd be doing it.
Yeah. That's the place where it's like, okay, what if I said something to this person, right? And then I was like, all of that emotion started to come up, like, oh, yes. you know, they're not going to be in my life and yada, 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 yada. And then I was like, okay, but I can choose to feel these things and I can still find yes. a way to say something.
Yes.
Right? Again, I can make a choice rather than like before that emotion would have just shut me down. I'd be like, nope, nope, we're not going there, right? We'll just keep swallowing whatever. But it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I get it. I see what you're feeling. I know where that comes from, but here's what I'm going to yes, do anyway. Yeah,
exactly. Years ago, yeah. in just before having kids, I had a friend that said, listen, you know, I want more time with you as a friend. You know, it feels like I don't see you very much anymore. You know, you're kind of, you know, heavily invested in the family and doing other things. But I just want to let you know, I really need more time. And I said, look, I can't, you know, in terms of where my life is. You know, us getting together or sharing time is going to be catch as catch can. It's not going to be, you know, to the degree it was before. And he goes, man, I just can't do that. You know, and I deeply appreciated him being able to say that because I know it had to be hard for him.
Yeah.
But for him, he just wanted more what we would, the kind of things that we would do before getting married or before kids. And I just said, that's not my reality. And he said, you know, I really don't want to invest in this friendship then because it's, wow. it's completely, yeah. And
it takes
I think
a lot
about
of guts.
That a lot. It really does. You know, I so admire, at the time I'm going, God, you know, what the hell? What that took, the guts it took to your point.
Yeah.
And that's why I think about it a lot. The courage it took for him to say that was big.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yes. Well, thank you so much, Patrick. This conversation has been so good. I mean, I could keep talking to you for hours. We could go with
another.
We might have to have a part two at some point. So where can people find your book? And your book is called Leading an Emotionally Intelligent Life. And where can people yes. find it?
Amazon. It's on Amazon.
Oh, perfect.
Rowan and Littlefield is the publisher, but you just go to Amazon. There it is. And yes. I mean, I hope you enjoyed reading it.
Yeah.
For me, you know, I frequently go back and read some of these stories about these individuals just because of how it makes me feel and
yeah.
how it kind of puts things in perspective for me. So thank you. Thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah. And the stories that you've shared are so relatable. I am such a big fan of people sharing their stories because we always see ourselves in other people's stories. And I think the stories really brought the concepts to life, which I found them incredibly helpful. So thank you for illustrating the way you did with those stories. And thank you to the people whose stories were shared.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. It was pretty remarkable.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Again, this has been an enlightening conversation. To everybody listening, go do yourself a favor. Get yourself familiar with the 15 competencies of emotional intelligence through Patrick's book on Amazon. I think you'll see yourself in a few of them, like I did. And just go get it. Great, great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Old Chicks No Shit podcast. If you like what you heard, the best compliment you can give is to share this podcast with a friend, subscribe, rate and review our podcast on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen in.